Hello, Kraft Heinz family and lead network partners and friends. My name is Pam A. Bassey, and I am the Chief Learning and Diversity Officer at Kraft Heinz. Thank you so much for joining this special International Women's Day event featuring award-winning and best-selling author of Invisible Women, Caroline Criado Perez. Today, we come together in a shared mission to break the bias and forge gender parity in our communities and workplaces, to actively call out biases and stereotypes, and create inclusive environments where women are seen, valued, heard, and respected. At Kraft Heinz, we call this living the power of we. The path to achieving women's equality is an ongoing journey. We have made much progress, but still have a lot of work to do. Here at Kraft Heinz, our commitment to inclusivity includes a commitment to increased representation of women at all levels of the organization and in all corners of the organization, from corporate and brand teams to the women in manufacturing who ensure we produce the best quality products. And it is a commitment to attract, retain, and develop talented women. I am proud to tell you that our commitments to live our values earned us recognition in the Bloomberg's 2022 Gender Equality Index, a first for our company. Companies reflected on the index are committed to building a more equal and inclusive workplace, investing in women and being transparent along the way. We are dedicated to investing our women's business resource groups, internal leadership development programs, such as the WE Network, external programs such as Linkage's Women in Leadership Conference, and partnerships with professional organizations like Next Up in North America, and of course, our beloved partner, the LEAD Network in Europe. Lastly, we bring awareness to the impact of biases by hearing from speakers such as Caroline Criado Perez. Caroline will explain how gender gaps in data affect everything from economic development to healthcare, education, and public policy. Moderating today's discussion is Senior Manager in People Analytics at Kraft Heinz, Husje Brummer. In her role, Husje combines her passion for people and psychology with data. And as advocate for women in the workplace, a longtime fan of the book Invisible Women, Husje works to close the gender gap in data here at Kraft Heinz. I am really excited to hear from Caroline and learn how we can play a role in designing inclusive solutions in the future. Again, thank you for joining this insightful event. Husje, over to you.
Great. Thanks, Mame. Caroline, we're very happy to have you us with here today in the Shard. Before we get started, just want to kick off with some few housekeeping items. For everybody with us today in the room, please make sure your phones are mute. And if you have any questions for the Q&A later, please use the post-its and the pens provided and pass over your questions to Asmita. For our virtual attendees, also a big welcome. The Q&A function is now live, so if you have any questions that you want to pop in, please feel free and do so, and we'll be able to address them later. So with that, the housekeeping is out of the way and we can get started with the exciting part. So again, Caroline, super happy to have you with us here today. And before we get off with like the more questions about the gender data gap, what I want to know from you first, as today is International Women's Day, what does International Women's Day mean to you?
Oh, a shock question.
I know.
So first of all, hello everyone. Thank you so much for having me here. What does International Women's Day mean to me? Well, I suppose it's an opportunity once a year to kind of take stock and think about if we have made any progress in the past year since the last time we got to talk about women on our one day a year that we're allowed to talk about women. What I always like to do on International Women's Day is give an opportunity for people to take an action as opposed to just have discussions. For some of you may know this, others may not, I write a weekly newsletter that's sort of continuing the conversation since Invisible Women came out. So for example, today I sent out a special edition, it normally goes out on a Monday, I sent out a special edition talking about the impact of war and conflict specifically on women, obviously focusing on what's happening in Ukraine at the moment, and the way that the sort of female specific injustices that come about as a result of war. So, you know, men and women both will face displacement, injuries, potentially death. But in the context of conflict, women will also experience a massive increase in domestic violence, in sexual violence, and also an increase in maternal mortality and also neonatal mortality, because women carry on giving birth even when there's a war on. They just stop being able to do it in safe conditions. So today I sent out a newsletter talking about that and talking and pointing people towards places that they can donate specifically for survivors of conflict-related sexual violence in Ukraine, and also to donate medical maternal health kits to women in Ukraine. So I see International Women's Day as like a way to focus people's attention on whatever particular issue I feel is particularly pressing on the day that International Women's Day comes about. And for obvious reasons, today I chose the women in Ukraine.
Thank you for that. And I think a great action indeed to take. So moving on then onto the book, where you talk about this gender data gap. And I think for me, that was absolutely eye-opening, as I didn't realize it exists. Because when we talk about gender neutral, we sort of assume it's gender inclusive. Because if we don't label it, then everything is covered in there. But then, surprise, it's not.
Yeah.
So could you tell us a bit more about the interest in this topic and what has prompted you to write the book?
Yeah. So that's a really, really long answer. I hope that that's okay.
We're ready for
it. so it all started quite a long time ago. So it started really when I went to university as a mature student, so in my mid-20s. And prior to that point, I hadn't been a feminist at all. I was an anti-feminist, actually. I would go as far as to say I was a misogynist. I thought very little of women. I believed everything that I had been told about women, you know, that women are hysterical, over-emotional, irrational, jealous, trivial, unintelligent. I just didn't think that I was like that. I was not like other girls. And anyway, so this was kind of my approach to feminism was, women and men are equal now, like we've got the vote, women can work. The reason that women aren't doing as well as men and aren't reaching like top positions and whatever is just the women are a bit rubbish. And if they would just try harder and be more intelligent and be less trivial, then they would be doing better. I was as totally insufferable as that sounds. And it wasn't till I got to university as a mature student that I had to actually engage with actual feminist writing and read about what it actually was. Because I just sort of believed it was man-hating and it just made women look bad and I found it embarrassing. Anyway, so I got to university as a mature student. I promise I don't think that now. You're all looking at me like I'm an awful person. I was a terrible person, but I've seen the light. So yeah, I went to university and I read this book called Feminism and Linguistic Theory, which is admittedly a very weird book to give you your feminist awakening. You know, it's not like I read The Female Eunuch or The Second Sex. I read Feminism and Linguistic Theory, and specifically a section on grammar. And basically what the book was talking about was the use of the generic masculine in language. So he to mean he or she, man to mean humankind, obviously like in gender-inflected languages, it's more threaded through the language, but in English, it's basically just that. And, you know, I think like a lot of people, I had heard these arguments before. Oh God, yeah, feminists complaining about you. Everyone knows it means he or she. God, they're so embarrassing. I, a very cool woman who doesn't hate men, understands that he is gender neutral. But the book went on to point me towards some data and some evidence that showed from studies that actually when people read or hear these words, they picture men. And the moment I read that sentence was the moment my life changed, because it completely blew my mind. It made me realize for the first time that I was picturing men when I saw these words. And I just could not believe that I'd never noticed that before. As a woman, you know, I hadn't noticed that I was always picturing men, despite the fact that I'd heard these arguments. And then I realised actually it wasn't just for these generic masculine words, it was for, you know, supposedly gender-neutral words as well, like doctor, lawyer, politician, writer, you know, anything that I might want to be, anyone who I might look up to. There was just men in my head. And, you know, I started thinking about the impact that this had on me and reflecting on my attitude to women, really, and thinking about how this might connect. You know, the fact that I had such little regard for women and all the people in my head who I might look up to were men. You know, I'd read literature by men at school and been, you know, books by men and about men. The history that I was taught was men's history. You know, when I went to the cinema, the films were about a male hero, and the woman plays the role of the nagging wife, like saying, you can't go and save the world, you've got to put the bins out. And, like, nobody wants to be her, you all want to be the hero. You know, I didn't identify with this version of womanhood at all. And but seeing, reading this book gradually made me start to realise that maybe, just maybe, I'd been lied to about women. And it wasn't that I was like not like other girls. It's that no one was like this. And so then I started to get really angry. And, you know, because I felt like I'd been denied access to female role models. And I felt like how much energy I'd wasted trying to convince people to treat me like a human being, despite the fact that I looked like a female, but I'm human, really. And I think also because that was my introduction into feminism, you know, I think there's lots of different routes into feminism. Like, people can come via, you know, sexual violence, or they can come via, you know, sexism in the workplace. But for me, it was recognizing default male in my own head and how the default human for me was a man. And that just blowing my mind that I didn't know what was going on in my own head and that I had this bias that I wasn't even aware of. And so because of that, I think that's why I started to notice when we are, when we think we're speaking gender neutrally, but we're actually speaking about men. And I started sort of unconsciously to start compiling this evidence in my head. So after my first degree, I went and I studied behavioral economics and feminist economics. And, you know, that was where I discovered, like, that the whole gender-neutral economic system, you know, the term GDP is sporting this massive, massive data gap because we don't collect data on women's unpaid care work and therefore don't calculate its contribution to GDP, and therefore when we're making resource allocation decisions, we're missing a massive part of the picture. I did some work with a female asylum seekers charity and there discovered, you know, that even this incredibly well-meaning piece of the UN Convention on Refugees, right? This was developed after the Second World War to ensure no one would ever be stateless. It was drawn up with the best intentions. And that's the thing. Like, a lot of this is just totally unintentional. No one drew that document up intending to make it harder for female asylum seekers to claim asylum. But that was what happened because they designed it around the experiences of male refugees. And so things like, you know, you have to leave the country that you're fleeing from to be able to claim asylum. That's much harder for women. They're much less likely to be able to travel legally. They're much less likely to be able to get a visa. In some countries, women can't even travel unaccompanied. And then even when you get, if you manage to get to a country, you can't just turn up and say, you know, I'm being persecuted, grant me asylum. You have to be able to show that your persecution fits these specific boxes, like I'm being persecuted for my religion, I'm being persecuted for my sexuality, which are reasons that women can be persecuted, but there isn't a box for sex and gender. And that is the number one reason that female asylum seekers will give for why they're being persecuted. You know, that's why women are raped as a weapon of war. That's why women experience things like FGM. And so basically for a female asylum seeker to claim asylum, she needs a lawyer. Most female asylum seekers haven't got any money. They don't have access to a lawyer. They don't speak the language, you know. So that was, you know, I guess sort of strike number two in my head. You know, alongside this, I was becoming totally obsessed with our failure to recognise how male-dominated pretty much everything is. And my theory for that is that it's the default male. We're so used to thinking of men as if they're kind of gender neutral, that they represent humans, whereas women only represent women. So, you know, I ran some campaigns. I ran a campaign for the Bank of England to include one female historical figure on the back of banknotes instead of having an all-male lineup. I ran a campaign for the first statue of a woman in Parliament Square, because up until that point, all the statues were of men. And, you know, I found that quite interesting in that I had been to Parliament Square so many times before, but had never noticed that all the statues were of men. You know, and this is me, like crazy feminist, obsessed with default male, never noticed. And had lots of women actually say to me as well, you know, how did we never notice that this square was all statues of men? Because we don't. Let me tell you, if it was a square full of statues of women, you'd notice. But it's part of this whole background noise of men being the default. So, you know, gradually building up my case. And then when I was writing my first book, I came across the medical data and basically discovered that in medicine, the vast majority of medical data has been collected on male bodies. So that's male cells, male animals, and male humans. And that the result of that is that women receive... take longer to be diagnosed for a whole host of diseases, receive worse treatment, are more likely to suffer from adverse drug reactions, and are more likely to suffer severe reactions that end up with them being hospitalised from those adverse drug reactions. And in particular, actually, it was a paper looking at women and heart disease and how... you know, like I think a lot of people, I thought I knew what the symptoms of a heart attack are, which is pain in the chest and down the left arm. And while women can experience those symptoms, actually women will be more likely to experience what feels like indigestion, breathlessness, nausea, fatigue. And so women don't realise they're having a heart attack because so much public health messaging is basically a guy clutching his chest. But then even more shocking to me was that doctors are not being trained in female-specific symptoms for a heart attack. And so women are being misdiagnosed, even if they do present at the hospital, realising that there's something wrong with them. Doctors are sending them home saying, you've got indigestion. And women are 50%, in the UK, women are 50% more likely to be misdiagnosed if they have a heart attack. And they're also more likely to die. And by the way, we think of heart disease as a male disease, but it's actually the number one killer of women in Europe and in the US. So it's a huge, huge issue. Anyway, so I sort of read that and, you know, having sort of been building up this like database, I guess, in my head, I got to that point and I just, you know, it was just like the final straw. I just felt I have to do something about the fact that this is happening. No one knows it's happening. Everyone thinks that when we're speaking gender neutrally, we're really speaking gender neutrally. And they don't realize that a lot of the stuff that we're talking about is really about men and that women are dying. So long answer over. that was what sparked my interest. It was really like a gradual thing and ended with a sort of an explosion. Ended in a book.
Which is great. Very grateful that the explosion happened and that we've got the book. Because indeed, there are so many different examples where we think it's gender neutral, so everything's covered, but it's actually not.
Yeah.
And before we delve into that further, I've got a question for you. Because the way that you were about, like, I'm anti-feminist, like, come on, what are we on about? Like, I'm special, come on.
Yeah.
I've been there too. And of course, we still have people like that, and you still get lots of pushback. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, like, as you were researching for your book and speaking to people, how did people respond to you when you challenged them on their views?
Yeah, so on specifically on the gender data gap. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's basically the excuse that I get given regularly is that women are just too complicated. Which obviously makes no sense. You can't say 50% of the world is just too complicated. We can't cope with it. But nevertheless, that is what is said. So, like, for example, I'm sure we'll get into car crash safety at a later point. But there was a fantastic quote from I can't remember his exact title, but he was like quite high up in Euro NCAP, which is the European Consumer Safety Body for car crash testing. And he said that when he was questioned on car safety for women, because cars are not as safe for women, he said, well, you could say the same about elderly people because they're not average either. Women are average. Women are average. But that sort of shows you the mentality, right? Women are just this weird, like, niche minority. He also said, you know, but now that we've done so much of dealing with the averages, we can start to look at the extremes, i.e. women. Again, women, not actually extreme. But that is the way that a lot of people think about women. And I think obviously, you know, if you really challenge them and dig down, they start to realize what a nonsense it is. But that's the kind of, you know, that's the bias. Mm. So yeah, I get told that women are too complicated. I've had researchers tell me, well, we can't include women in the research because the menstrual cycle will interfere with the results. And yes, the menstrual cycle will interfere with the results. And sorry, that is why you need to include women in your study. So for example, you know, menstrual cycle impacts have been found. There's probably way more that we don't yet know about because we don't study the menstrual cycle. But so far have been found for a whole range of medications where depending on a point in the menstrual cycle, the dosage may be too high or too low. Women are more likely than men to experience drug-induced heart rhythm abnormalities. The risk is highest during the first half of the menstrual cycle. So it's a nonsense to say that you can't include the menstrual cycle. And also, again, I would stress that 50% of the bodies of the world have a menstrual cycle. So it's, again, not this niche minority issue. The other thing that that I get told is, and I suppose I should say, point out that cells don't have a menstrual cycle. So wouldn't explain why 70% of cell trials are in male cells. Why does that matter? Well, because there are sex differences in cells. So for example, one study was a sex disaggregated study looking at male and female cells and exposing them to estrogen to see what the impact would be if they were able if they were exposed to estrogen before being exposed to a virus. And they found that the female cells were able to use the estrogen to somehow fight off the virus. It was the flu virus. The male cells were not able to use the estrogen and weren't able to fight off the virus, which was a study that I reported on in Invisible Women. And then, of course, during the pandemic, I was just like, holy shit, this is really fucking weird. And there were actually some studies during the pandemic where doctors were trying to inject male COVID patients with estrogen and with progesterone to see whether it would have an impact. Every time I've checked on the results of those studies, they have yet to publish their results. I suspect they probably won't, because based on this study, it looks like it's not just about injecting men with estrogen, that there's something else going on there. But, you know, that's a huge data gap, that if we'd been bothering studying women from much earlier on, who knows what understanding we'd have had about how estrogen interacts with cells and what might we have been able to do in this pandemic, what treatments might we have had. Another example of how cells can respond differently depending on sex is for years, researchers were really baffled by muscle-derived stem cells in that they seemed to behave completely unpredictably. Sometimes they would promote muscle regeneration, sometimes they wouldn't, until someone thought to sex disaggregate the data. And it turned out they weren't unpredictable at all. It's that female cells promote regeneration and male cells don't. So like, how much time and money was wasted just being like, what's up with these muscle-derived stem cells? What are they doing? So anyway, sorry, I'm going off on a mad tangent here. What are people's reactions? Right, so the other thing that I get told is, well, we'll start off in men. And if we find anything interesting, then we'll add women at a later date. And I think the examples I've just given about the stem cells and the influenza virus should hopefully explain why that is a terrible idea. So yeah, it's really frustrating, but you know, the bias is so inbuilt. Like I challenged one researcher and asked him, you know, why are you starting off in only in men? And he gave the line about, you know, we'll start off in men and add women at a later date. And, you know, it's cheaper to start off in one sex. So I was like, okay, fine. But why is it always men that you start in? Like, why don't you just try starting in women, see what happens? Mad idea. He said, that's a very interesting idea. And I haven't heard back.
Well, let's see. Well, and I think this is great to show how ingrained it is.
Yeah.
That people are just so assuming that like male is sort of standard and it's like really ingrained in people and the average is men, it's not women and so on. And I'm curious to hear from you, how can we counterbalance that rather than like, of course, directing them straight on when we're seeing these biases, but how can we as people create better, more inclusive data? Is it just diverse teams that we start considering things more broadly or anything else that you recommend?
I mean, diversity is hugely important because diversity will impact on, you know, what is even the problem that you are trying to solve, right? It will impact what questions you ask of the data, what questions you ask to elicit the data. There's very strong evidence showing that diverse teams do more diverse research, are more likely to sex disaggregate their data, are more likely to do gender analysis of their data. So, you know, that is a really important part of it. I think it is also about having procedures in place where, you know, changing what the default is. That the default isn't that we don't sex disaggregate our data. The default isn't that we only collect data in men. The default is that we collect sex disaggregated data unless there's some very, very good reason not to do it. And that's basically my prescription.
Yeah, making sure that we disaggregate our data and understand the impacts on both groups.
Yeah.
And you've already given a couple of examples also about like heart attacks and that was like really the final straw as to what really prompted you to write the book. What was your most shocking thing that you saw apart from the heart attacks?
I can't give a heart attack.
No, I'm sorry.
So I briefly alluded to there being a shocking statistic about car crash safety. So let's talk about car crash safety. For decades, the only car crash test dummy that was used, and it's still the most commonly used car crash test dummy, was based on the body of a 50th percentile American man, as if the average American man represents the average global human. That body is too tall and too heavy to represent the average woman. And the result is that there are all sorts of ways in which cars have been designed to be safe for that body and that therefore are unsafe for other bodies. So, for example, women are on average sitting much closer to the steering wheel than the average male car crash test dummy. The reason for that being that women are on average shorter than men and they have to sit further forward to reach the pedals and the steering wheel, which are also quite important part of car safety. But that puts them at a higher risk in the event of a frontal collision. Women are often found to be wearing seatbelts improperly, and I put that in scare quotes because it's not really our fault, it's that it hasn't been designed for a body with breasts. And it hasn't been designed for a body that sits about the average height of a female body. And the thing that I find really frustrating about this is when you talk about seatbelts, there's always someone who pipes up saying, yeah, but you can pay extra to have the seatbelt adjustable. So, right, I have to pay extra because I'm of the 50% of the population that isn't an average male body. Thanks. Added to which, often the lowest setting is still too high for the average woman. The height thing really gets me because I've realized recently how just bizarre it is that I've spent my life thinking I'm short. And actually, at 5'5", I'm tall for a woman. The average height for a British woman is 5'3". But because, you know, I can't reach anything, I've spent my life thinking I'm short, and actually, no, it's just the world has not been designed for people of my height. Anyway, sorry, back to cars. So the other examples include things like the seat backs being too firm. This is not about comfort. This is about the seatbelts are that level of firmness because they have been designed to absorb the weight of a much bigger, heavier body. And because women are on average lighter, because we're on average smaller, women get thrown further forward in the event of a crash. So, you know, maybe wearing the seatbelt improperly, sitting further forward anyway, this and other issues come together to mean that in the event of a crash, a woman is 73% more likely to be seriously injured or die than a man in the same car crash. Now, I should say that there is what is called a female car crash test dummy. It's just a very, very scaled down version of the male dummy. And of course, women are not just small men, right? There are some other differences, like muscle mass distribution, which is quite important when it comes to car crashes and car safety. So men tend to carry more muscle up on their upper bodies than women. Differences in the pelvis, differences in things like spinal column flexibility, which, as you can imagine, is also very important when it comes to car crashes. And these aren't accounted for in this female car crash test dummy, added to which they don't really use it. So the female car crash test dummy is mandated in only one out of the five regulatory tests in the EU and only in the passenger seat. Is this me? Carry on. Okay, sorry.
Nothing's happening.
So things are happening here. Only in the passenger seat. So we literally don't collect data with this female car crash test dummy in the driver's seat. And I don't know about you, but I find that pretty shocking.
Very shocking. Very shocking.
You kind of have to laugh because it's so ridiculous. But I think it's a really good... But it's also not funny at all, right? Because women are dying. Women are being seriously injured. They're being maimed. They're having life-changing injuries and they're dying because of this bias that somehow it makes sense to the head of Euro NCAP that women are extreme and that the male body represents the average human body.
Yeah, and I think this is a good example of something really bad, that actually because we're not taking women into account, they're more likely to die and have like been maimed and everything. And now with the pandemic that we've been going through, like health is much more at the forefront than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. You've already alluded to the study you've seen with estrogen and how that has actually made women, when we've injected them with it, that they were easier or better resistant to influenza virus. And I'm wondering, with all these great bad examples, have you seen any great good examples of where they've actually used the data well and made progress and improvements for women specifically? I really hope you're going to say yes.
No, not really. Sorry. But I mean, I think that shouldn't surprise us, you know, because most people don't realize that they're doing this. And there's still a lot to be done in terms of awareness raising for people to first recognize, you know, that we have a problem and that we need to be collecting better data and that we need to be gender analyzing that data. And we just aren't doing it yet. And that isn't widespread. I mean, you know, you mentioned the pandemic. It took ages for most countries to even be presenting their data in a sex disaggregated way. And, you know, that this matters for men as well, right? In this pandemic, men were more at risk. And it took us longer than it should have to realize that, because most countries weren't sex disaggregating their data and they weren't publishing sex disaggregated data. And the other point, of course, being that you needed to have the data disaggregated to know whether it was a biological issue or whether it was a social issue, right? Were men more likely to catch it or were they more likely to die from it? And if you're not collecting sex disaggregated data at all points, you're not going to be able to answer that question. And most countries were not doing that. I think there has been some improvement. One of the things that I found really interesting in the pandemic was it felt like I had never seen as many articles about the differential economic impact of the pandemic. This was not surprising because that this always happens in any kind of disease outbreak or any kind of conflict situation, basically any disaster situation. But we haven't tended to talk about it. So, for example, Ebola and Zika, for example, women were much more affected by both those viruses. Women were much more likely to die from Ebola. That was mainly because women were more likely to be exposed to Ebola than men, because they tended to be the ones doing the informal care work. But despite, and Zika was a particular issue for pregnant women. But despite the massive, difference between its impact, there was very, very little attention paid to that in academic research. I think it was something like 1% of papers published on Zika and Ebola had any form of sex disaggregation of their data or any form of gender analysis whatsoever. And that did seem to be different, at least in terms of the conversation we've been having about COVID, that there has been much... Do you need me to shut up?
No, please do continue.
Okay. much more conversations going on about it. And the other thing I kind of think is there's been an interesting shift in terms of the recognition of the fact that women's unpaid care work exists, and we might need to start recognising that in the workplace, which is something that feminists like me have been banging on about for a decade, because I've been a feminist for a decade, but there are other feminists who've been going on for much longer than I have. And my theory, basically, is that the pandemic made unpaid care work salient. It made it visible in a way that it hasn't been before. And it really reminded me of this thing I write about in the book. So in 1975, the UN declared that it was the year of women. Is anyone here alive in 1975? Can you tell me how amazing 1975 was for women? Is it just like women doing great things everywhere? I don't know. Anyway, they declared it the year of women. And in Iceland, they wanted to mark this in a special way. And so the women of Iceland got together. I just love this. They got together and they were like, what are we going to do for this year of women? And they decided that they'd go on strike. And they decided to strike not only from their paid work, but also their unpaid work. So they didn't do any cooking, they didn't do any cleaning, they didn't do any childcare, and they didn't do any of their paid work. And they all just congregated in public squares. And hilariously, this day came to be known by the men of Iceland as the Long Friday. And they sold out of sausages, because that was like the number one convenience food at the time. And kids were like everywhere. They were like interrupting broadcasts. And I don't know if you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, that's what it was like. All these kids like interrupting their parents on TV and like interrupting Zoom calls. And, so anyway, after this Long Friday where the men had just had this terrible day, a year later, Iceland passed its Sex Discrimination Act. I think it was like 4 years later, they elected one of the first democratically elected female heads of state. They regularly top the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Index. Like, Iceland's doing pretty well. And you can kind of trace it back to this
Long Friday.
Where unpaid care work became salient. You know, and I feel like as a global social something, as the world, we've kind of had a little bit of a Long Friday. It's been a bit worse than a Long Friday, I would argue. But, you know, we've had that same experience. And you do see companies now coming out and recognising that actually unpaid care work isn't like a private matter for their employees. It's a business issue. And that they're going to have to start addressing it seriously. Yep. So, no, there aren't great examples of where we've collected sex disaggregated data and everything's now brilliant. But there are promising noises at the very least.
That's good. Maybe next year, International Women's Day, we could make it Long Friday, all women go on strike. Take that as an action.
Great idea.
I'm up for that. I think we can mobilize more people for this. I'd love to ask you many more questions, but I've also seen some posters going through the room, and I'm sure that we've got questions coming through with the Q&A as well. So I'm happy to now bring Asmita onto stage. Asmita is our the leader of our Gender Equality Network here in Ustard and takes many initiatives to improve diversity, inclusion and belonging here. So Nita, Asmita, please come join us.
Thank you. Testing.
Yes. It's working.
Hello to everyone in the Shard and joining us from beyond. Caroline, we were whispering because we had so many questions that I was quickly organising them into
groups.
That was it.
I thought she's going off topic.
No, not at all. That's our big challenge. I'll zoom in on the workplace, if that's okay to start with, because really we're a company of so what as well, and we really want you to help us answer it. One of the questions I'd love to ask is, what actions do you think we can take to drive the biggest impact at work towards a more inclusive approach to decision making?
That's a really interesting question. I think the most important thing that you can do in any area of your business when you're trying to make an impact is to start off by collecting data about where you are. So who is speaking up in meetings? What is the problem? Do you have a problem? Who is taking decisions? And then you implement your whatever the change is going to be, and we'll get to that. And then you collect data again at the end of it. And I say that, even though it sounds really, really simple, most people do not do that. Most companies do not do that. And it's almost like they don't actually care if their initiatives have an impact or not, because otherwise, why wouldn't you measure and then do the intervention?
Thank you.
The intervention and then measure it. So that's the first. I'm sure that doesn't happen here.
That's why I'm here.
So that's the first thing. I can tell you what I think definitely doesn't work, which is just trusting that because you're a meritocratic organisation, everything will be fine. And that's for two reasons. One, actually, organisations that pride themselves being on meritocratic tend to be the least meritocratic. And also, from sort of my experience working in any kind of office, I worked in a couple of offices where there was a sort of the idea was that it's a flat structure, everyone's equal, and anyone can speak. And bless the CEO of that company, he really believed that that was the case. And he just didn't notice that actually he was the one speaking and that none of the women were speaking, because none of them would dare speak up to him and speak back to him. So what I'm coming to is that you can't leave it to chance, and it's quite boring, but basically you need to have quite structured approaches, you know, that include a lot of data collection and a lot of measuring. There are certain things, like other things that you can do, like some companies have instigated like a no interrupting policy, or, you know, measure the amount of time that people can speak. It depends on the kind of company you are. Like, that doesn't work for all companies. Some companies don't like working like that. But essentially, it's about measuring what's going on and implementing a solution based around where your problems are.
Great, thank you. I love that, Caroline. It links back to, I think, the speaking in meetings in particular. What we discussed before was when someone has more of a comment than a question on the topic that's actually being discussed, and they take the floor. We've had some quite vulnerable questions come through as well, so I'll protect the anonymous attendees. But there is a really serious one, not submitted by me or Husia. What would you say to professional women who worry about supporting gender parity initiatives for fear that it could undermine their success? Mm. Because I'm sure there was some brownie point associated with not being like other girls.
Yes, there absolutely are, which is why a lot of women take that route, certainly why I took that route. And there is data to prove it, right? So female leaders and ethnic minority leaders who support diversity initiatives are seen more negatively, whereas white male leaders who support diversity initiatives are seen very positively, because they're seen basically like the white male leaders are seen as like, what a great guy, he supports diversity initiatives. But the female leaders and the ethnic minority leaders draw attention to their femaleness and their ethnic minorityness, which is not seen as effective in a leader. You know, we're not seen as natural leaders. So I don't have a good answer for that, because unfortunately it is a problem and you may well take a hit. But ultimately, the way I think of it is that you're going to be taking a hit either way. You know, you're already taking a hit as a result of being a woman. You might as well try and change the structures so that other women can rise up and you can change the culture of your workplace, rather than being in the position that I feel I was in when I was a teenager, which was constantly trying to persuade people that I'm not like other girls. You know, that's actually quite exhausting. And that's probably not actually very good for your career either, if you're wasting half your energy. You know, there's some interesting studies that's sort of slightly connected, I think, of the difference in how girls perform in maths tests if before they take the test they first have to tick a box saying whether they're male or female. And if you tick, if girls tick the box to say they're female, they do worse at the maths test, because it makes their gender salient. And they remember, oh shit, girls are bad at maths. I got to prove that I'm not bad at maths. And this is, by the way, you know, girls at college who are taking higher maths, like they're good at maths. But the gender stereotype takes up space in their brain. You know, thinking I have to challenge the gender stereotype is taking up space in their brain. That means that they don't spend all that energy doing the maths test well. And I sort of feel the same about women who would rather just sort of hope that people somehow don't notice that they're women and that will make everything okay. There's a lot of energy that goes on to doing that as well. And also it's not really successful because they can see you're a woman.
Yeah, it reminds me of this lovely Nora Ephron quote. I think it's from a graduation speech, and she says, you know, make some trouble in the world, and if you can, make it on behalf of women. So
that's a great quote.
I love the advice. Caroline, we also had one on, I guess, what are the initiatives beyond closing the data gap that you've seen that seem to be effective in promoting gender parity and equality? You know, what are the types of initiatives you would partner with?
So this really comes down to transparency and accountability. So there was a really great example of a tech company that I came across in the course of my research, which became really, really serious about closing the gender pay gap and the gender promotions gap. And they did this basically by making managers accountable for their hiring and promotion decisions. And they knew that they were going to have to, at the end of the year, sit down in front of a panel who was going to have all the data. I'm afraid actually it does include data, sorry. Everything includes data on what their hiring decisions were. And ask them to defend them. And just knowing that, and that they were going to be asked to defend, why do you not have a diverse team, meant that they ended up with diverse teams. And they basically got rid of their gender pay gap in 5 years. Then there are all sorts of initiatives that are really important for this kind of thing, like thinking about job ads. There's so much about the language of your job adverts, and there's actually some really great little tools out there now that can like scan the language of your job ad to make sure that it's not putting women off with like. I kind of hate talking about this because it sounds so ridiculous that there are words that are male that put women off, but we live in a stupid gendered world, and I'm afraid that there are words that are associated with men that make women feel like they don't belong in a job. And so avoiding them is important. Then, you know, obviously there's the obvious stuff like having proper maternity leave, having proper paternity leave. I feel like paternity leave doesn't get enough of attention, but it's so important. Evidence from Sweden shows that for every month of paternity leave that a man takes, his female partner's salary goes up 7%. That's huge. And there's also evidence showing that men who take paternity leave are more involved in childcare. And again, that's very important because women currently do 75% of the world's unpaid care work, and that has a huge impact on their ability to engage in paid work. which has a huge impact on the gender pay gap. So basically, I keep coming back to, if we're serious about solving the gender pay gap, we need to solve the unpaid care work gap.
That's a great answer, Caroline. And we also have a lot of our PNP team in the room who are actually implementing a lot of these types of policies, as well as some very prominent male leaders at the back who have taken advantage of the paternity leave policy quite recently. So I think that will lead me on to
Can I just say, yes. That's very good, and I'm very glad to hear it. And that is actually a very, very important part of it, is male leaders, you know, living that, you know, living what they preach. And there was a really fascinating study that looked at, basically it's the concept of pluralistic ignorance, which is basically you think you know what other men are thinking, but actually you don't. And so they surveyed all these men at this bank and asked them, you know, do you think that men should be able to take paternity leave? And basically all of them said, yes, men should be able to take, you know, a good amount of paternity leave. Do you think your male colleagues would support you in taking maternity leave? Oh, I don't know. I don't think most of them would support me in taking paternity leave. And so there was this big mismatch in what the men actually thought and what they thought other men thought. And then when they told them, OK, so actually this is what you thought your colleagues think, this is what they actually think, and men's likelihood of taking paternity leave shot up, basically, because they realised that they had been mistaken about what their male colleagues thought. And you can't discount the importance of peer pressure, you know, the importance of what are my colleagues going to think about me. And there is still peer pressure for men, or they think that there is, you know, men feel that there is peer pressure for them not to take this kind of leave. And so it's incredibly important that leaders, male leaders, model that behaviour of flexible working and taking paternity leave.
I think ours was particularly well supported as well by other leaders then stepping up to cover those positions in the interim, so not leaving that gap. And I think it contributed to the effectiveness. So we actually have two, I'm going to make this my penultimate, not my last question, because we had two blinders come in at the last minute. do you believe, I'll say the question behind the question. We have set ourselves an aspiration globally to have 50-50 gender parity across all management levels by the end of 2025. Do you believe this is effective? Do you think setting these targets is impactful?
Setting targets is indispensable. You have to set targets. The evidence is very, very clear that if you don't have specific targets, you don't get anywhere. Yes, it is effective. Like there's not much more I can say about that. Yes, you have to set targets, and if you don't set targets, you won't achieve anything.
Great, limited debate on that one from us. Works out well. And then the final one is really, how do we bring men into this conversation? There's a few questions that are linked to that topic. How do we bring men into these conversations and not just the most engaged men? You know, when you're preaching to the choir.
I really feel like men need to answer that question because I'm not a man. I mean, I can tell you what I try to do. I mean, basically, to be honest, this book is part of me trying to bring men into the conversation because I was like, data, men like data, right? Write a book about data. I suppose I come from the position that when I was this insufferable anti-feminist, misogynist woman, I was trying to be like what I thought men were like. Because I wanted to be accepted by men, because men are the protagonists of life and they hold all the power, and obviously I want to be like them. And the thing that convinced me was being presented with the data. And so that's one of the major reasons that I wrote this book, was I wanted to convince people who weren't already on board and show them, but look, this data is inarguable. You know, you can't argue against women being more likely to die in a car crash. You can't argue against women being more likely to be misdiagnosed if they have a heart attack. So my approach is to go to the data, to present the evidence. And the added benefit of that is that you're not trying to engage with people on an emotional level where they can get defensive. And also because you're talking about systems and you're talking about bad systems based on bad data rather than bad people doing bad things to good women. Again, it removes the emotion out of the conversation. I think it makes it more possible to have constructive conversations. And then also you can build on that to have the more difficult conversations.
Thank you. That's the end of our questions, although we have many more, which maybe I'll email you after. Husay, Caroline, I'll hand back to you to do a wrap-up.
Thanks, Asmita. Thanks as well so much, Caroline. I'm looking now at the team, and I feel like I can ask one final question, because with all of this, I'm just really curious. The book has come out now a couple of years ago. Uh-huh. How optimistic are you about our future?
Oh,
just to end us off on hopefully a good note. I'm hoping that the answer will be very, and then we're all good to go.
It really depends on what day you ask me. You know, I think that there are signs of hope, but there are also incredibly frustrating obstacles. You know, there are so many things that I write about in the book that it makes no sense to me that these are problems that still continue. So, like, when you talk about, I mean, how is it that we still don't even have an average female car crash test dummy? How do I explain that? I don't know how to explain that. We're still having to have this argument. Like, we don't even have the regulations to say that the small male dummy that is supposed to represent women is included in the tests. Why hasn't that already been fixed? You know, we've known for decades that women are more likely to die as a result of a heart attack, and yet we are still continuing to do the majority of research on male bodies. So I find that really frustrating, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it, because I don't have the answers for why we aren't fixing these things that are glaring injustices. That said, you know, I do think that there are certain areas where finally we are recognizing that this isn't just a women's issue. You know, for things that are like affecting the business bottom line, right? So unpaid care work, that is now recognized as a business issue. And so there are signs that things are gonna get a bit better there. But we have a long way to go, and we have a lot of data to collect. And, you know, we didn't have a chance to talk about this, but, you know, one of my big concerns is with AI, which is being introduced to all sorts of areas at a rapid rate, and is affecting all sorts of decision-making, from, you know, HR decisions through to medical diagnostics. Mm-hmm. And the data isn't there, and the algorithms are being developed without any awareness of the fact that it matters that the data isn't there. And by the way, algorithms don't just reflect our biases back at us, they amplify them by a significant amount. So that is a huge concern for me, and something that we need to get a grip on quite quickly.
Yeah, thank you for that.
So sorry, that wasn't a very hopeful ending.
I think the hopefulness that we can distill from this is that we all have a job to do here.
Yes.
We can all help to make it better. So I think in that way, there is still some optimism in there. We can all contribute ourselves and really try to close that gender gap in data, but also in a way that we contribute to our business. So with that, I want to thank you again so much, Caroline, for joining today. Thank you as well for the audience here live in the chart, as well as the audience all dialing in through Zoom, our lead network partnership as well, and Asmita for being our wonderful raving reporter. So with that, thank you very much, and I'd like to ask for a big applause for Caroline.